you know, it's like finding happiness, right? You're happy sometimes. Sometimes you don't feel happy, but feeling alone or overwhelmed as a CEO is just something that's going to be part of your experience.
What one go-to-market tactic or strategy that's been working for you at Common Ring?
Yeah, so one of them is signal collection. A lot of companies are leaving a lot of revenue on the table by simply not capturing all the signals that they are already generating.
One is a listener question. I'm finding the solo founder journey becoming unmanageable. How should I go about identifying a co-founder and convincing them to join the journey?
Finding great co-founders starts with what you need and what you can define clearly.
What is one widely held belief that founders believe to be true that you think is bullshit or no longer serving us?
There are no playbooks for building startups. If you find product market fit with one persona, well, you may need to evolve the year after that to expand your personas.
Behind the scenes, it was a small group of people that were doing everything.
Slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
I want to know how this insane growth actually happened.
What are you doing when no one's around, no one's looking? Are you just showing up in front of memory, or are you approaching it like a pro? Be a student of the game.
This episode is brought to you by DemandBase. DemandBase helps B2B companies hit their revenue goals using fewer resources by using the power of AI to identify and engage the accounts and buying groups most likely to purchase. Their account-based technology unites sales and marketing teams around insights that you can understand and facilitates quick actions across systems and channels to deliver big wins. It's flexible, scalable ABM built for you. Hello and welcome back to the GTM podcast. You've got Scott Barker here. I'm off the road this week, which feels great, back in the war room in Vancouver. And my guest is actually closer than they usually are. I am joined by Linda Leanne down in Seattle. Linda, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Great to be here.
Are you having a decent winter like we're having up here in Vancouver? I feel like it hasn't been that cold, hasn't been that rainy. Just very rare for us Pacific Northwest folks.
Yeah, it's a lovely spring day. We've had some record-breaking highs recently. So I'll take it because, as you know, there's about 4 months of just darkness and we're emerging into the light.
We are. The seasonal depression is slowly shaking off a little bit, which is nice.
Folks are putting away their sad lights, right?
Yeah, exactly. I definitely have one of those, funny enough. I can't complain. I got some sun down in Austin, Scottsdale, heading to LA shortly. So I am getting a little bit of sun. But so I always like to give quick context for our listeners. So Linda is the co-founder and CEO at Common Room. Common Room has been an incredible partner for GTM Fund and GTM Now. And if you're not familiar with them, they are a all-in-one customer intelligence platform that automatically surfaces signals across 30 plus channels, reveals the person and account behind that signal, and automates actions like email messaging and team alerts. So if you've run a sales team, run a marketing team, you know the importance. And Leanne founded Common Room in 2020, really to unlock siloed, previously untrackable signals, to really transform how organizations connect with people and their prospects and their customers. And before Common Room, Leanne led product marketing for serverless computing at a little company called Amazon Web Services. I'm not sure if anyone's heard of them before. Where really this is how you found out about the problem is you saw sort of firsthand the impact that connected data and person level insights, not just company level, had on accelerating product adoption, earning new customers, and expanding account revenue. Anything else I missed out there on the bio that's important to highlight? There is one thing. You actually started your career on the VC side. So I went operator, then went VC. You went VC and then operator. How was that transition?
Oh, man. Yeah, I spent the first half of my career really working in finance, right? I started at an investment bank, learned Excel. I was an early stage investor. I would say that for me, the biggest thing about finance versus being an operator is, you know, I think in finance, you really learn to look at from a high level view all the signals of business health and growth, and you learn the frameworks and the ratios of what you should be looking for at different stages of, you know, company's maturity. But as an operator, you know, you're able to kind of, I think about a strategy, figure out how to execute it, and then reap, for me, the dopamine hit and the rewards of the learnings. I love to learn. And I think with investing, it's like you get to learn about so many things. And, you know, it's really fun to kind of be academic and dive into technologies, but you don't get to go as deep. So I would actually say I consider myself not to have been the best investor, but I also didn't realize what the role of investing really was all about, which you are doing such an incredible job of, which is, you know, the thought leadership, having, you know, industry shaping voices come on. So I wasn't doing any of that.
Yeah, it's cool to see the venture landscape, you know, switching a little bit. You're seeing a lot more operators with like true experience building, you know, coming over to VC, a lot more, you know, content and talent. It's been cool. But okay, I'm going to zoom out and use my, you know, purview of kind of this whole space. And I've been super fortunate to kind of be in sales tech, rev tech for a long time and seeing kind of the evolution. And I think for the last at least 6 years, you know, all you can hear from the best revenue leaders is, okay, we need to, first it started with, we need to collect more data. It was, you know, we need more data. It's going to inform our decisions. And for a long time, we were just in this collection process and it was great. We had a lot of data, but it would just sit somewhere and maybe you'd use it on a board deck to just like enhance your opinion that you wanted. And it wasn't always overly scientific. And then we got to this era of, okay, we can kind of use some of this now and we can use it to inform our decision making. And it feels like we're for the first time getting to this place where we can use in time, real time data to actually inform not just like business level decisions, but like rep user level decisions, which gets to a really exciting place. And I wanted to talk to you about this idea that we've had kind of this customer intelligence for a while. We've been collecting it for a long time. And it was previously known as like intent data. And now there's a lot of people talking about like signal-based sales or trigger-based sales. What are the differences between those two in your eyes?
So Scott, I definitely think that our renaissance on go-to-market is here. So if you think about the last 20 years of go-to-market tech history, and maybe we'll start with kind of the inception of Salesforce in 1999, Salesforce was really about digitizing a physical piece of paper, which is the Rolodex, right? And a lot of the great software companies that were built in that time were about digitizing paper. Look at LinkedIn, for example. It's digitizing your resume and putting it, you know, in an accessible place. But I think over the last 20 years, and we've seen with many technologies, as you go from this early kind of like innovation stage in software of digitizing paper to getting to a place of prescriptive intelligence, right? Hey, like the machine is, you know, being fed the right data is going to actually tell me more than I could know manually. And maybe with some math, right, with some models, it can actually tell me a lot more than what I could understand as a human. And so I think we're there, right, with the rise of AI and all that. But like when you talk about, hey, like there was a moment in time where in go-to-market, we said, we need more data. Like that was really the rise of, you know, almost like the CRM 2.0s, which weren't like head-to-head with Salesforce, but you saw the creation of Segment, right? Or you saw the creation of Snowflake as a customer data warehouse, lots of high touch census, reverse ETL to get data from Salesforce to other places. So there was, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years ago, a spurt of innovation that was really centered around customer data, moving it, gathering it, and making it actionable. I think to your point, like the current iteration is this concept of data isn't really enough. Like having it somewhere locked up in your Snowflake data warehouse doesn't actually enable your rep who just started 6 months ago and now has to learn 12 different tools what they're supposed to be doing on any given Tuesday, right? Like you go to your work on Tuesday, you got all this data in your Snowflake data warehouse. How's that going to help you go and reach out to the right people and to build a book of business and to like hit your goals? And I think there's like a parallel here with intent. So, you know, I think in the early days, it was really about like, you know, can I understand which accounts are showing intent? And the six senses of the world, right? There's a lot of kind of under the hood magic that really, it's not black magic, but it is like, you know, tracking things, you know, anonymous visitors to a website. And that's why with intent, it's rarely ever actionable immediately, right? Intent data is really good for ABM tactics like advertising on LinkedIn, which can be very expensive nowadays, right? But as a rep, as a SDR or an AE or a growth marketer, knowing that Nike is showing vague intent signals somewhere out there on the internet doesn't actually help you with your job on a Tuesday. And so, Scott, when you're talking about signal or trigger-based, you know, signal-based selling or trigger-based, you know, plays or trigger-based go-to-market execution, you know, we like the word signals. It's really about identifying those critical moments, but tying it to a person or an action that is immediately actionable. And so a couple of super like tactical examples would be, you know, a director level plus persona looks at my pricing page on my website. And I can see that someone on their team who works at the same company recently started a free trial of our product, right? That on a Tuesday, that's going to help you. That's going to help you craft a really personalized message to the right person, right? It's going to help you kickstart that relationship because you already have the 360 context of what they've been doing across all of these different touch points that you as a business already have today that are just simply not gathered in one place. And so when we say signal-based go-to-market, that's the difference.
I love it. And it feels like the promise that we were made many years ago when we started collecting the data, but it wasn't at the fingertips of everyone that you could actually make day-to-day decisions on. And it's cool that we're there. And it does feel like that is the new go-to-market 5.0, like the days of just straight cold email and we just need to do more are gone. We can actually run intelligent go-to-market and it's going to benefit, you know, both the buyers and the sellers, you know, because I think buyers are also just, you know, so inundated now. And even if the perfect tool that solves their problem, you know, lands on their doorstep, if it's not thoughtful and approached the way that you just described, you know, it's going to usually fall on deaf ears. But I want to ask a bit of a, you know, we'll call it a hot take, because people have mixed signals on this. Going back to what we're talking about in kind of RevTech as a whole, Salesforce, you mentioned, founded 20 years ago. Many of us owe, you know, this SaaS world that we live in to Salesforce. So thank you, Mark, and everyone else who was part of that journey. But it's built on a legacy data architecture. And most tools are built for Salesforce, you know, really with them at the core. And then we built on top of them. Do you think to get to this next evolution, something is going to have to dethrone Salesforce as that core?
Great question. So agree with you. Huge respect for Salesforce and Mark. I don't think there's a founder in this world who hasn't studied that story and, you know, it's an incredible innovation story. But you're right. It is built on a 20-year-old data architecture for building relationships with customers. And think about how much consumer behavior has shifted over the last 20 years, right? Everybody is digitally literate. So you have the rise of free trial and try before you buy. People are more tech savvy, so they don't necessarily want to engage with the sales rep super early in a sales cycle. Selling is getting harder and harder. I mean, man, like I consider myself to be a part of our sales team. If I had to pick, right, I sell and I have massive respect for the art of selling. It's freaking hard because, you know, your average rep has to onboard onto how many different tools, right? You have your intent data tools, you have your contact databases, you have LinkedIn, you have your internal, you know, reports that show signals that, you know, are unique to your business, like maybe product usage data. You have a Tableau dashboard somewhere. You also have to learn about, you know, the persona you're selling to, the segments that you're covering, how the technology works, how the product works. I mean, this is a lot for anybody, including me, right? So selling is also getting harder and harder. At the same time, these consumer behaviors are changing. And so if you think about 20 years ago when Salesforce was founded, their biggest innovation was that they were moving the Rolodex, the CRM, the like repo of what your reps think is happening and what they're doing, their activities, moving it into the cloud. I think today we're saying, hey, like, you know, the one thing from a data architecture perspective that Salesforce never built, and, you know, I've spoken with many people there who have said that over and over again, they tried to build it, the people object. There is no person object. So like when we look at the Salesforce instances of our customers, like Scott, you as Scott will likely be there like five different times, right? And like, when you talk about a customer experience, like your engagement with a brand, and that being like coherent and cohesive and customer centric, it's almost impossible to render a coherent customer experience across the whole journey when the system of record has you living in like eight different places. And so for us, like, you know, when we started Common Room, we really asked ourselves the question, let's not go head to head with Salesforce. Like, we're not building Salesforce. But if we were to build a modern platform from the ground up with the latest and greatest technologies available, right? Gen AI, like real-time data streaming, NLP, AI, computer vision and recognition, and all those great things, like, where would we start? And we said it's really three foundational concepts. It's who they are, it's where they work, and also where they worked. So their whole like job history of employment. And then it's their engagement or that activity, right? Did they like your company LinkedIn post? Did they go to your website? Did they start a free trial? For developer tooling companies where, you know, go to market is even more of a black magic exercise, right? You know, are they starring a GitHub repo? Are they asking a question in your community? There's so many different signals now. We're expanding our signal set extensively. So we're adding, you know, the ability for you to track job postings. That's a really big one, right? A company is posting about a job that mentions your tech stack, your competitor's tech stack, or the personas that you're interested in. Like, there's so many incredible signals out there. I think the challenge is like, how do we bring it all together? And then to your point, we talk about this as we call it the last mile. How do you actually take all this intelligence and this data, prioritize it for your reps? There's a couple ways that you can prioritize today that we've seen work, and then ultimately feed them these insights and these moments on a silver platter so that when your rep logs into Common Room or whatever their customer intelligence platform is on a Tuesday, instead of going to 10 different apps or looking in 10 different places to even figure out where they should be focusing their time, there's a very prescriptive set of people and orgs that have fit some engagement criteria, right? That you can now go and reach out to again with this incredibly targeted and personalized message where you're actually adding value in that first touch.
I like that new world that you're describing. I can, you know, just going back to my selling roots, imagine the power of having a holistic view on, you know, Linda, the human from your time at AWS, from your time at Madrona, from all of these lived experiences, and then a bunch of signals through all of that. Like all we capture now is, you know, this tiny portion of your life. And then we try and infer all of these things. And it doesn't, you know, sell the whole idea of who Linda is and how you can actually, you know, sell to them. And I do love, you know, I think technology always, the promise of technology was going to make our lives more simple. Has not been the case for sales professionals. You know, it used to be you've got a phone, you've got your Rolodex, and you're making things happen. That's pretty simple. And now we've layered on all this incredible complexity. You've got to interface with like 13 different technologies. But I think in the world that you're describing, there's a lot of complexity happening in the back end. But the way that we interface it is, you know, this is the right person, this is the right time, and here is your next best action. And I've been hearing that next best action in RevTech for a long time. And just no one has lived up to that. No one has lived up to that promise.
You know, as an outsider to RevTech in many ways, I mean, I've been doing this for 4 years now, but I hadn't been in RevTech before. I've been in developer tools. And, you know, developer tools, like the technology, you say it's going to do a thing, it better do a thing, because the developers
or you're going to get smoked.
Yeah. I mean, the developers have no, there's no room for vaporware. And so when I came into RevTech as an outsider, I was actually shocked. I was like, wow, there's so many vendors that are saying they do a thing where we'll go look into the technology and it's like, there's nothing there. And so, you know, you're tapping into something that is like philosophically so important for Common Room. And, you know, what we like, we're so passionate about this, which is like, it's about time. It's time that go-to-market and RevTech got tech that fulfills the promise, right? That isn't vaporware, that does exactly what it says it's going to do, exactly the way that you expect it'll happen. And that's something that, you know, I like, we live by that. And like, we never want to ship anything that isn't going to, like, once somebody uses it, right? Once you try it out, you're not going to be like, oh, this works.
And I think it's perfect time to be, I think, where you're at, because, you know, the tide is going out. And I think two things are happening simultaneously. One is, you know, a lot of budgets are constricting within RevTech. It used to be heydays, like, oh, if it increases anything by 1%, let's do it. The budgets are constricting. And then at the same time, sales people and marketers are getting more and more tech savvy. So people actually know, you know, had the rise of RevOps. So there's a lot more of a technical component to modern sales and marketers. And so now they're actually able to ask more of those developer-like questions and see under the hood of what's going on. And I think, you know, they say is when the tide goes out, you see who's, you know, wearing no pants or whatever the expression is. And that seems to be happening. There certainly is going to be a flight to quality in RevTech and a new expectation set. And it's cool to see Common Room leading that charge. So before we switch gears, and I want to talk to you about your time at AWS, because I imagine that was super formative for you and when you started thinking about a lot of these ideas. Before we get there, I have to ask, because I've been fortunate enough to meet quite a few members of your team, and they are awesome. They are really good human beings. They're incredibly responsive.
How have you gone about recruiting, retaining, and building that culture? Because that's essentially what a startup is, just a collective of humans trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, we're 55 people, so we're relatively small. And so every person counts. You know, I always say, like, the company we build is the team we build. And from day zero, I knew that if this was going to be, you know, valuable for the industry, and if we could build something enduring that makes the lives of go-to-market professionals better, it would take a set of brilliant individuals that were far better than me their crafts. And, you know, I think as somewhat of a jack of all trades, master of nothing, like my whole career, I was actually quite, I was always like trying new things. And, you know, I did not have a traditional like vertical path, right? It was very horizontal and meandering. I think I always just appreciated the incredible people that I had worked with that were so much better than me at marketing, at sales, at product, at engineering, that I never even like conceived of a different world than just finding people who, you know, A, like were incredibly good at what they do. Like they're achievers. They've always been achievers. You know, look at their history. Like, were they achievers? Because people don't just become achievers overnight, right? They have a track record of doing incredible things, whatever that means for them. And I think that's really important. Like, if you're going to hire people that look just like you, you're kind of like, you know, narcissist, like looking in the mirror, liking your own reflection too much, right? Like, so I think that's part one, just like a deep appreciation for the diversity of skills and wanting to find the person who is like really, really great at this. And I think as a founder, you just have to have no ego. You have to be like, hey, I don't know what I don't know. And I know I don't know demand gen marketing as an example, right? I think the second piece is, you know, and I'm learning and growing as a leader too. I had never been a manager before starting this company, right? Now 4 years later, it's very different. I think it's about like, instead of micromanaging people on tasks, let's get aligned and inspired by our shared vision and a set of values that like we can all say as humans, like this resonates with us. And so you talk about like ownership, for example, like, you know, we only have four company values. There's only four and we keep it very simple. It's customer obsession. So like, hey, we're not going to go build vaporware because like we want to actually like help people. And that's our customer obsession. You talk about responsiveness. That's customer obsession. Like you're a partner of ours, you're a customer of ours. And, you know, our second value is like bias for simplicity. We like to keep things simple. Smart people embrace complexity, and there's a lot of complexity in what we do, right? I think go-to-market is one of the most complex functions and crafts of a company because you're not in full control of anything. Your customers have far more control and your prospects have more control than you. So I think, you know, what can we do to make things simple, right? And so we have, you know, two other company values, like we're all in this together, but we kind of live and breathe by the values. It sounds very cliche, but it works. And so if you're a founder and you haven't implemented values that you kind of map back to and you refer to and you interview for, and, you know, it's percolating through every decision you make, how you talk about challenges and opportunities. And, you know, for us, like that has been the central, like, part of it. And so very tactically, what we would do is like, you know, if we're trying to solve a problem, like there's a moment where somebody on the team, no matter what their seniority might be, like they could be the CEO, me, or they could be an intern, it doesn't really matter. They can say, hey, like, I feel like the solution that we're proposing isn't very customer centric. Like, think about it from the customer's perspective. Like, what's their experience? Or, hey, it feels like we're like, can we bias for simplicity here? Can we bring it back to the essence of what we're doing? And so we really do use these values in our day-to-day like decision making and how we debate concepts and ideas. And that's really powerful to me because it doesn't matter if you're an intern or a CEO, when you speak in the language of company values, you're always going to have a platform to stand on. You will always be heard. And I think empowering people to feel that way is really important, right? Like we've all been, you know, in that job where we had the best ideas, but we didn't know if anybody was hearing us. And, you know, I think constructing a culture where there are tools for everybody to be heard is like really important.
Those values definitely shine through, and you can see that your team is very much living them. One question I had, and I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way to do this. I've interviewed founders that it's gone both ways. Those values, was that something that was really important to you? And you're like, okay, I'm going to create a company on these values. Or did you start building and then look around and then it was kind of like the team created the values a little bit?
It's a little bit of both, and we've like changed our values, or we added a value and we'll take them away, right? I think they need to work for us. We don't work for them, like the values. All hail the values. Like, that's not like that.
There's new data coming in. You might get new intelligence that you need to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're loose constructionists. We're not like, this is the Bible. Let's interpret it for the next 100 years. But it's also one of those funny things where when you're starting a company, you'll have a lot of advisors or like more seasoned operators being like, oh, you should do this. You should do like vision and mission and values. And you're like, yeah, okay. But then, you know, 4 years later, I'm like, wow, being forced to do that by some advisor was the best thing that's ever happened to us. Because we set our vision on day zero and it's never changed over the last 4 years. We want to go transform how organizations connect with people. And like, you know, you're going to go through twists and turns as a startup, ups and downs. You're going to, you know, sell to one persona, then evolve to another. You're going to be PLG and need to be enterprise, or your enterprise need to go PLG. Like, there's so many things that will happen in the course of company building. But like that vision that you started out with, that North Star of like, hey, what are we going to be about 100 years from now? I can say like with confidence, we'll always be about building technologies that help organizations transform how they connect with people. And like Common Room has evolved a lot. We started out building for community managers and developer relations practitioners who are very much left behind by go-to-market and rev tools, simply because they were kind of this like niche team that did engage with customers, but weren't really tied in with the rest of the go-to-market team from like a process perspective or a data perspective or a tooling perspective. And we've really evolved to serve, you know, CS, to serve outbound, top of the funnel, demand gen, AE, sales teams, marketing teams, of course, community and DevRel teams. But, you know, as we have evolved, our vision has stayed with us. And I think that is really important for every founder to think deeply about, like from the beginning.
The way you achieve the vision can always be changing, but the underpinning, you know, here's what we're going after has remained the same, which is really cool. All right. I want to take you in a time machine real quick and transport you back, because we love stories on this podcast. Transport you back to your time at AWS, your kind of owning business outcomes on the serverless computing business unit at AWS. How was that experience? Vastly different than, you know, being a CEO, so many stakeholders involved internally, externally. I guess what were some of the challenges that you faced there?
Maybe to take the story even a little further back, and this is kind of how we started out servicing a lot of, you know, OSS and developer companies that sell to developers. So in 2016, I was a junior investor at a VC fund in Seattle called Madrona Venture Group. And one of the best things, as you know, about the opportunity to be a VC is you get to dive super deep into the industries and businesses and the business models that are kind of fundamentally reinventing the way that software is being built, and distributed, and adopted. And so when I was an investor, I got to see firsthand the rise of all of these new kind of go-to-market motions. And it was 2016, so it was very like in its infancy, but it's things like, you know, user-led or product-led growth, right? It's community-led. It's, you know, we were in the early innings of this community practice or this DevRel practice. It's like, what does it mean to go and engage with your prospects and your customers in channels that aren't CRM, a sales meeting, and a Zendesk ticket and email, right? Like, we were seeing that, you know, at that time, a lot of people who are looking to buy software really wanted to engage in the digital watering holes where they were already having those conversations and they were already doing their research, like LinkedIn or Twitter or, you know, Slack or Discord or Reddit. So we were already seeing a lot of the early beginnings of this when I was an investor. And these early impressions really instilled in me this notion that there was a seismic shift happening in how people were finding and adopting software. So this was further validated when I joined AWS. I am, you know, this was the heyday of the DevOps revolution. AWS invented, frankly, a lot of developer tools at this time that are so critical to building modern apps like serverless and containers. And at AWS, we found that a lot of these the most innovative services that we're experiencing, like gangbusters growth, like 300% year over year, 600% year over year. It wasn't through like this traditional sales-led model. It was rather through enabling developers to get hands-on with a free trial, to have places they could access where they could feel supported in like trying out the software, whether it's forums or Slack groups or even on Reddit. And then kind of building and scaling like influencer or champion programs that would spread kind of education about these new technologies and enablement to like more developers globally. And I think a lot of these tactics today are very sort of table stakes for the modern sort of SaaS companies that, you know, we're building for. But at the time, they were relatively newer tactics. And it felt like it should be a win-win for our developers, our customers, and our business. But what I ended up finding, and you talk about like business ROIs, like I'd be in these reviews with our senior leaders, or even like Andy Jassy, and he would ask, I know we need to go engage on Twitter or LinkedIn. Like, I know that we need to open source this thing to, you know, get it into the hands of more developers. Like, I know that there's a lot of people engaging with my latest LinkedIn post. And, you know, those are all potential customers and prospects. My question is, how can we measure any of this? Like, where is that data? Is it in Salesforce? Right? Like, we're putting people against resourcing these tactics. Like, what are we, how do we measure success? And I was shocked that there wasn't a tool. So you had like social listening and you had CRM, but I was like, wow, like what about all these engagement channels that people are naturally engaging with our brand on? We're completely blind to the dark funnel. And, you know, Gartner has the stat that by the time a prospect engages with their sales rep, they're probably over 70% of the way through the sales cycle already. Like they've already made their decision. And so a big part of this is like, how do we shine a light into the top of the funnel? How do we really get earlier in that engagement cycle when people are doing the word of mouth, when people are, you know, doing their own research, asking questions online, trying the product silently for free? Like, how do you get visibility into that? And so that's kind of where we started, right? We were just like, hey, let's go and aggregate the engagement happening in these very siloed, highly fragmented, sometimes owned like a Slack or sometimes unowned like Twitter. Like, can we bring that all to one place? And as we did that, our customers were like, wait, can you bring in product usage signals? And we're like, yeah, that's just another signal. And they're like, wait, can you track, you know, new job postings? Yeah, sure. Why not? Can you go and scrape any LinkedIn post to see who engaged? Yeah. Can you have an LLM agent that goes and, you know, I can ask it a question and it can go and search for a new account list for me? Yes, today we can. And so it kind of just built on that. And one of our big goals is, you know, we want to be the most comprehensive place for people to go and get that bundle of signals. Because when we talk to customers and other folks in the rev tech space, a lot of it is overcoming the, you know, vendor fatigue, the vaporware fatigue, and the implementation fatigue. You adopt a bunch of point solutions, you're going to have to bring it all together and make it work for your team. And that's where a lot of tools don't get implemented. They don't deliver on the ROI and they don't get like the outcomes that they promised.
So interesting. So I always love asking this question. So you're at AWS, you see this problem firsthand, you look around and you're like, nobody seems to actually be solving this, or there's people trying to, but not in the way, you know, I think it should be solved. Do you remember that moment where you're like, I'm going to go solve this? And what was that like to just take that plunge? Cause if anyone has ever started anything, no matter how small or how big, there's this moment and it's a crucial one. What gave you the confidence to go and solve this huge problem?
Yeah, it was definitely the meeting with Andy where he was like, okay, like how are we supposed to measure this? And I was like, wow, we're creating like a massive strategy at AWS, putting a bunch of teams against this and we can't measure it. Like that's not, I was like, I got to go solve that. The second one though, and this is far more, I think, empathetic to our customers and who we built for, is my life was so incredibly manual. So, you know, you mentioned Rebecca. She and I started the serverless, the AWS Heroes program, which is the global, you know, champion program with all the MVPs and influencers. And a lot of companies are building influencer programs to scale out, you know, their reach. And we would just be going through Twitter, like manually looking for people that mentioned us, looking up who they were, trying to figure out where they were, putting them in an Excel spreadsheet, like reaching out to them across, you know, we'd be like, oh, let's try DMing them. Okay, did that work? Let's try LinkedIn messaging them. I mean, the work was so manual. It was manual list building. It was manual collating of people's, you know, engagement on the internet, what they cared about. It was a manual research about where they worked and, you know, did it make sense for the program we were building? And I remember actually there was a night where I think I had to pull an all-nighter just doing incredibly manual work. I mean, you know, we had a Slack group that had 60,000 developers in it, and I would manually try to figure out if they were customers or not. Like, imagine the work that would take to do that. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. And, you know, I think being at AWS, it's just such a disconnect between, again, these incredible technologies that we're building for app developers and then kind of what, you know, being on the go-to-market team was like. And this is no knock on AWS at all, but it was just this huge disconnect between what go-to-market teams had access to from a technology perspective and then like what, you know, engineers, product managers, developers have access to. It just didn't make sense to me.
Frustration and the question, there's got to be a better way, is how I think most of the greatest companies of our generation have been built. It's sometimes that simple. It's just, we can't keep doing this like this. There's got to be a better way. So
it's frustration. It's
yeah, pain. Too much pain. Okay. This has been awesome. Thank you so much for the time, Linda. I have three final questions as we sort of wrap up. And one is a listener question. This is an interesting one. And question is, I'm finding the solo founder journey becoming unmanageable. How should I go about identifying a co-founder and convincing them to join the journey? Would love your thoughts. I think it's a great question.
A couple things. First off, if you're the founder and CEO, it'll always fall on you. That will never change. Whether you have co-founders,
you're saying it will
not
always be unmanageable. is that what you're saying? That's not the secret bullet to becoming manageable.
Let's normalize feeling alone and overwhelmed all the time, because that is just the facts of this job. Like, it's a part of the experience that, you know, it's like finding happiness, right? You're happy sometimes. Sometimes you don't feel happy, but like you would say on average, you're happy, right? I would say on average, like things are going great, but also like feeling alone or overwhelmed as a CEO is just something that's going to be part of your experience. The second thing is finding great co-founders starts with what you need and what you can define clearly. So when I started Common Room, I knew that the first thing I wanted to do was get customer validation. So sequencing is important, right? I brought on my design co-founder first, Francis Liu, who's incredible. He was the 15th product designer at Facebook. But I would say a lot of people probably would not jump to hiring a designer or bringing on a design co-founder as the first thing. So this is where it's like going to be unique to you and your business and your journey. What we needed to do very urgently at that time was to quickly iterate on product designs that we could show our design partners, our early customers who are paying us in cash at the time. They were paying us in their time, basically, and giving us feedback, right? And so with Francis, like, I also was very clear on the type of product designer co-founder that I was looking for. It was someone who, you know, had experience. Like, I'm not a designer. Like, in fact, my first meeting with Francis, I brought like a notebook where I had like sketched boxes. It was very embarrassing, but I didn't know anything about product design at all. So I wanted someone who knew what they were doing. And I knew that we were building a product that had a human element to it. Like, we're all about building relationships. We wanted a delightful UI that any sales rep or marketing person could use and not have to learn SQL. So that usability and that human element was super important to me. And so Francis, you know, he's the 15th product designer at Meta. He built, you know, newsfeed, Facebook groups. I mean, just incredible amounts of, you know, human relationship building software. And so when I met with him, you know, I had a really good hook for why he should join. I was like, oh, well, like, you know, we're kind of trying to reinvent what connection means in the B2B space. Right. So you're immediately mapping to something that's like highly specific and relevant to their experience, but also something that they're like, oh, I can really help with this. You know, I think everybody, if someone's going to join you as a co-founder, they want to know that they're going to make a massive impact. And they want to know why it is about them that is specific and unique so that they can be successful and make an impact. And I think like with Francis, it was just very clear. It was a great fit. Like, he knew that he could just make an incredible amount of impact, and he has. I think the other piece of it is like, I met him on LinkedIn in that, like the Tinder for B2B, in that I cold messaged him on LinkedIn. You know, I had no connections with Francis, and he ignored my first message. So like, sequencing is important. I think the second lesson is like, keep following up. You're going to get 100 no's. In fact, most people will just ignore you. But with Francis, you know, I just felt so certain that there was something there about his background and what we were doing, that what I would do is I'd message him. He didn't respond. I would wait a month and then message him again, but I would update him on our progress. So if you were to ask him why he joined, he's like, well, I read the first message. I ignored it because, you know, I don't know who you are. Then you message me again. And you said, hey, I've left AWS. I've gotten funding. Like, we have design partners. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of progress in, you know, a couple months. Okay, now I'm going to meet with you. And so it's similar to like sales 101 tactics, right? But it's like, hey, follow up and share relevant updates. And then I think, you know, the third thing is just meet them where they are, right? Like with Francis, he, you know, if you're going to go and try to hire exceptional talent, it's, you're going to be reaching, right? It's not an easy hire. You're going to be reaching really high, getting someone you never even imagined you could get. And that's going to take you meeting them where they're at. So Francis was a first-time dad. You know, he couldn't really go full-time right away. And so we just started jamming, and we set up a consulting agreement where, you know, he did a certain number of hours with us, and he opted into doing more hours. And so you're setting up a structure where you can test it out on both sides. And then when it works, it feels very organic. It's no longer this big thing of like, wow, I'm trying to find a co-founder, right? And I actually met my engineering co-founders in the exact same way. I cold messaged them on LinkedIn. They didn't respond. Viraj, my CTO, who's incredible, he didn't respond. I messaged him again, right? And then I got him on a call. He had very relevant experience. He had, him and Tom, my other engineering co-founder, had built a community-centric, you know, music streaming app. They had also built a bunch of PLG tools at Dropbox. So again, it was just a, like, I'm really looking for that experience and that relevancy. And then it's the follow-up, it's the meeting them where they're at, right? Viraj had a very big job at Convoy as chief of staff that, you know, we needed to kind of work through. So it wasn't like a normal interview process. It was a period of collaboration with people that just fit on many different dimensions, and sequencing how you, like, who that person is first is also really important.
Yeah. It's a fantastic story. And for anyone who says cold LinkedIn DMs don't work, there's an example. You got your co-founders from a cold LinkedIn DM. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I also got my job in Madrona as a VC through cold LinkedIn outbounding. I am like the LinkedIn outbounding success.
We need the playbook. I think we need the Linda playbook on the cold LinkedIn DMs. All right. Final two questions.
Personalization,
relevant, using intelligence. There we go. We've come full circle. So final two questions. First one, is what is one widely held belief that founders believe to be true that you think is bullshit or no longer serving us?
There are no playbooks for building startups. Yeah. And having, you know, we started the company, like, I think we were getting our seed round into the bank the Friday that the markets shut down due to COVID. So like whatever pretense or visions we had about building a team, like, went out the door immediately because we were like, oh, now we have to build a early stage team completely remote. You couldn't even meet anybody, right? Or the fact that, you know, when we were founded, it was the industry was incredibly hot, right? A lot of hype and valuations that now seem too high. There was a big focus on growth at all costs. You know, you could just spend your way into growth. You know, startups were, I think we raised our Series B like pre-product. So just to give you a sense of like what the state was at that time with the markets and how different it is today. And I think through COVID and through kind of this cycle we're in, it's just there's no playbook. Like, if you find product market fit with one persona, well, you may need to evolve the year after that to expand your personas. You know, we have a bunch of customers that have been wildly successful with a PLG motion that need to now build an enterprise motion. And just because they have a wildly successful PLG motion doesn't even mean that they have product market fit in enterprise, right? Just because you're an enterprise company doesn't mean that, you know, you won't have to go down market and appeal to a more SMB base because you want to get higher velocity sales going. So it's so unique and specific. And we advise so many of our customers on building their go-to-market strategy that unfortunately the one consistent trend is that there is no playbook, but there are like specific tactics that do work and you can certainly apply them right to your situation.
That's part of the reason we try and speak through stories as much as we can on this podcast. It's hard to just break down a playbook, but we are with you that there is tactics, tried and true strategies that do work, but they are also ever evolving. Something that works right now, not going to work in 6 months time. Which leads me to my next question. It's tough times out there. What's one go-to-market tactic or strategy that's been working for you at Common Room?
Yeah. So one of them is signal collection. We dog food, you know, we obviously use our own product. It's actually pretty incredible. I think like half of our leads from last month were through Common Room. And so what we do is we map out, you know, Kevin White, who's our head of demand gen, has an incredible post where, you know, he published 100 relevant signals for modern go-to-market teams. And you can go and see like which signals, you know, apply to your business. But what we did is a simple exercise of, and he has a worksheet on this actually, but we just, we kind of covered all the doors. It's like, hey, where are people engaging with us? What are all those doors? It's inbound signups. It's free trials. It's engaging on our social media pages with our content. It's visiting our website. It's looking at our pricing page. It's, you know, it's commenting on, you know, when you put out this podcast and folks comment on it or engage with it or like it, we bring that signal into Common Room because we're like, hey, like, that means that those prospects or potential customers are really aligned with our view of the world. They, you know, are looking for a solution to the problems that we talk about. Like, that's really great, like, personalizable, actionable, intense signals. And so the first thing we do is we bring in all the signals. And I think a lot of companies are leaving a lot of revenue on the table by simply not capturing all the signals that they are already generating. So I always start there. It's like, hey, like, let's leverage what you already have. There's a lot of optimization we can make just in helping you get visibility and unite all these signals in one place.
Yeah. And I mean, the results speak for themselves. If there's any leaders out there not, you know, fully embracing this idea of, you know, signal-based sales, I think it's time. And go talk to Minda and the Common Room team. They are pros leading the charge. And Linda, thank you so much for the time. That was super fun. We'll have to have you back, but thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's so great to be here.
And for all those listeners, I always say it, you know, listening is one thing, executing is something totally different. Hopefully you take some of these tactics, strategies, stories that we talked about, apply them to your business and help you hit your quarter. Have a great year, and we will see you next week.